Hello, I'm Brian Talbot. I've been writing and drawing comics and graphic novels for about 40 years now, and welcome to The Geek Show.
Hello, and welcome to Four Panel. Once again, we're here to talk about some comic and manga-related nonsensory, which I realize is like an actual thing that means can't be experienced by the senses. Not that, I mean, it's weird and we ramble a lot, just like I'm doing now. Therefore, this is the perfect introduction. And it was delivered to you by me, Andrew, and that guy over there is Rob.
Hello.
Yeah, so I was, you brought it back around.
I was a bit worried about the non-sensory. I was like, what's going on? Have you been reading Dora Rob as well?
Oh, I can't read what I can't pronounce.
Yeah, this is true. Before we go any further with this nonsensory, Four Panel is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network, and if you like what we do, then show your support, make a donation, or buy one of our lovely bits of merchandise. You can find all those links on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, and if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, or various other places on the internet. And now on with the news in a non-sensory way.
You're not going to let me live that down, are you?
No.
it was a scary experience, Rob. It's like when you're a pilot and you just suddenly lose control of the plane and you're desperately trying to pull it back up.
All you can hear is your own voice going, "Mayday, mayday, mayday." And I can never do Mayday now without remembering Red Dwarf and Rimmer going, "Why is it Mayday? Why not another day? You know, Shrove Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday."
Anyway, news.
Yes.
So, basically, after that rambling introduction and everything, we don't actually have any comic book or manga news, but we do have comic book movie news.
Yeah, I know, it's weird.
That'll do.
Yeah.
So, first up, kind of heard for a while now that Domino is probably going to be in Deadpool 2, and now we know she definitely is, and she's going to be played by an actress with possibly the best name I've ever seen.
Oh?
Daisy Beetz.
Sorry, what?
Daisy Beetz, and that is like B-E-E-T-Z, like a really gangster beetroot.
What was her first name?
Zazy.
Zazy?
Yeah, like Z-A-Z-I-Z-I-E. Oh my, I can't do words or letters.
It's because of all
such
that...
such a long week, Rob, and I just want to sleep.
It's because of all those top tens you've been doing. You must hit the count from Sesame Street. One,
Oh, my God, shut up. I'm going to ram a stake through his heart. Then we'll see how he can do his numbers.
Yes, Andrew has a job as a writer, and we'll leave it at that. We're not going to go any further into that because of the memories and the trauma.
But yeah, Domino, would you like me to basically recount every single thing about Domino that's ever been written? Because that's what I pretty much had to do a list on yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, but this is what happens when you start a top 10 interesting things about Domino list and then, like, get to 6 and realise you've run out.
I thought the most interesting thing about Domino was... well, I didn't really find much interesting about her.
I really like the way that she can deliver pizza in 30 minutes or less.
Wasn't she part of X-Force at one point?
Oh, yes. She's, like, one of the main X-Force people.
And that's about all I really know about Domino.
She was also part of Cable's Mercenary Group Six-Pack.
Okay, that's another thing I didn't know about Domino that I didn't really care about anyway. So
shut up. Yes, you do, Rob. You care enough to read an entire entry on it. Because that's what your people are getting, goddammit.
So, really, this is like therapy for you now, isn't it?
And this is literally the only reason I brought this story up, is so that I can vent that it's been such a long week.
Okay, vent away. The Doctor is in.
Actually, one of them is just that one time she did the business with Wolverine.
That's like saying one time someone did the business with She-Hulk during the 90s, because everyone did the business with She-Hulk during the 90s.
I know, but Domino's such an uninteresting cat. She just shows up and shoots things, and that's all she does.
So basically, she's like every 80s action hero from Hollywood.
Well, more importantly, she is like every single Rob Liefeld character, because that's who came up with her.
Oh, yeah, I remember now. Oh, God. Rob Liefeld.
Because I think that might have actually been like the breaking point. It's having to like tab back over to Comic Vine and just stare at Rob Liefeld art.
I'm glad you said art. I was wondering where that sentence was ending.
I mean, you say that. he's not a bad-looking guy. I think I would actually rather stare at just 22 pages of his face
than his art. So, I have to ask then. Rob Liefeld came up with Domino, and that kind of explains why she's a bit crap when you get right down to it. I know that you and I both like Blink, yeah?
Yeah, yes, we do.
And there is a reason we like Blink, because Blink is kind of interesting when you get right
Blink
down to it.
Hey, she's not just interesting, she's the number one most interesting X-Man that you've probably never heard of.
Yeah, but Domino, as you said, makes me think of pizza. And aside from knowing that she was part of X-Force, I honestly didn't care about Domino because, you know, I treat her in the same vein as I treat someone like, I don't know, Strong Guy from X-Factor.
I think I might actually prefer Strong Guy.
Well, he was a lot funnier, especially when he's trying to drink tea, you know?
I mean, to be fair, Strong Guy just doing anything is hilarious because he's so weirdly proportioned.
Yeah, I know. He's kind of like the Hulk meets Blob when you get right down to it.
Oh my God, he is the guy you grew up with who was really fat. And then like you meet him a few years down the line and he's just got like weirdly ripped instead.
You're exactly right, actually. So hang on, what does that make Domino? Is she the weird girl who you had this weird crush on in class, but then you lost touch, and then now you meet her, and she's...
Because she is the weird crush. She's like the slightly gothy chick weird crush.
Yeah. Okay. Now we know why Rob Liefeld created her in the first place.
Although, do you want to know a fact that is actually technically kind of interesting?
What?
Rob Liefeld didn't technically create her, if you go by continuity.
Okay.
Because who he actually created was Copycat, who was a shapeshifter who was pretending to be Domino.
Okay, so he created Copycat, who's pretending to be Domino. So who created Domino then? Because Domino had to have been there for Copycat to make a copy of her.
Yeah, I think, so I guess technically like Fabian Nietzsche.
Okay.
Because he's basically like the writer who did the plot twist that, surprise, it's actually Copycat.
Okay.
And then it was like, this is the real Domino. Comics are weird, right?
Yes, comics are weird and strange, and I totally agree with you on that front, that comics are weird and strange.
God, we have just done an entire segment which is me moaning about my life.
Therapy, see?
Who cares about the listeners? I'm having fun.
Yeah, don't stress yourself about it. Anyway, shall we move on to Charlize Theron?
She is always a good topic to move on to.
Please rephrase that.
Okay, I'm sorry. She's a very beautiful woman and therefore a really great topic to move on to.
That's better.
No, it's not, Rob. It's in fact worse.
Okay, so Charlize Theron is in kind of a superhero movie. We saw the trailer for it.
Yeah, it's an adaptation of a comic book.
Well, I say superhero movie. Yeah, comic book movie, sorry. My mistake. Which comic book is it? Let's start off with that.
Well, we should probably start. The film is a film called Atomic Blonde, which is based off the kind of graphic novel The Coldest City by Anthony Johnston. I'm going to look this up like what I should have done if I was an actual professional.
It's called Atomic Blonde, and as soon as I saw the title, my first thought was, Debbie Harry, Atomic, that's what I'm thinking. So I'm thinking it has...
Anthony Johnston.
Yeah. I'm thinking it has something to do with Blondie, you know, the band, not knowing that it has anything to do with comic books, because I haven't read The Coldest City, didn't know anything about it. So then I go to it and find out it's The Coldest City, and I thought, I wonder if Andrew's read this.
I have indeed read it. In fact, I even read a signed copy what I got signed.
Okay, it's just cool.
Signed copy.
So then your opinion of this trailer, because you obviously can compare it to the graphic novel.
Oh boy, can I? So the first thing I want to say is that actually I think the trailer looks kind of awesome.
Okay.
Because it's just like Charlize Theron like chopping dudes in the throat and kicking them downstairs.
Yeah, it was very John Wick.
Yeah, it is. It's basically her doing John Wick. The Coldest City is like a Cold War spy thriller about a woman in 1960s Berlin trying to track down a list of secret agents who have been... their cover's been blown.
Okay.
And contains absolutely no scenes of her chopping dudes in the throat and kicking them downstairs.
Okay. But it contains a lot of thriller type thing, a lot of espionage, a lot of tense moments.
It's like, it's a very sort of John Le Carré, straight-laced, very serious spy thriller.
Okay.
And they've turned it into John Wick with Charlize Theron, which, to be honest, I have absolutely no problems with.
Okay, yeah. I'm fine with this. I mean, a few good explosions, some random punching in the throat can spice up any movie. After all, Die Hard would have been much more boring if he didn't have a machine gun.
So you said, you've actually only seen half the trailer, haven't you?
Yes.
Which, Rob. Yeah. You haven't seen the bit where she meets the French operative.
Oh.
Basically, it's a French woman that she meets in a bar and then just immediately smashed her cuts to them like making out in the toilet while Toby Jones awkwardly listens in back at MI6 HQ.
Hang on, Toby Jones is in this?
Yes.
Yes.
But like Toby Jones and John Goodman.
All right, okay, there's the dream team right there. I'm down with this.
It looks so good.
That's actually a pairing that I've wanted to see in a movie for a while, is John Goodman and Toby Jones, because I think the two of them would just work so well together.
It would be a sight to see.
Yes, because John Goodman's really come on in leaps and bounds since Roseanne, back in like the late 80s, was it? Since then, he's really come along in leaps and bounds as an actor. And now you look at him and he's like, he's just so good in most of the roles that he's in.
Yeah, it always confuses me to see a clip from Roseanne. I think that, like, that's acclaimed Hollywood actor John Goodman.
Yeah, I know.
I'm so very confused.
And people...
He was in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, I know.
What's he doing in this?
People always forget that Roseanne was actually a thing.
See, I kind of remember it just from reading about like how insanely depressing the last episode was.
Oh, the last episode. We don't talk about the last episode. It was just depressing.
Actually, I don't know why I'm worried about spelling. John Goodman was dead the entire time.
Hello, this is Ryan from the Geek Show Podcast Network. Do you like trees? What about paper? What about words? Yes, words are good. Then you will like Literally Loitering, only available on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Hello, fellow Vault Hunters. I'm J. Michael Tatum, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares.
Welcome back, and now it's time for some comics and some manga, and a very big manga at that.
I mean, I like that you're being mysterious about it, even though we mentioned exactly what it is in the introduction.
No, we didn't. That was a weird fevered cheese dream you had, where you couldn't pronounce the name.
So scared, because that's also incredibly likely.
let's proceed in a non-sensory way.
Indeed. So, Rob, you know what?
What?
Over these past few weeks, I've been reading a lot of really good comic books.
Okay.
And they're all stuff that I would love to be able to talk about in the show.
Okay.
But I'm not going to, Rob.
Okay.
Because instead, I have to talk about Inhumans vs. X-Men issue 6.
Ah.
God damn. Like, it's almost impressive, Rob.
Okay.
Because I thought, I'm so cynical now. I've seen the truth. I know how the world works. There's no way that Marvel could ever possibly disappoint me ever again.
And you were wrong.
So they keep finding new ways to pull it out of the bag. So issue 6, so this is another thing.
Yeah?
Of Inhumans versus X-Men, I've read issues 1, 2, and 6.
I've read it all.
I'm confused as to what I've missed, because this seems like pretty much where issue 2 left off.
It kind of is. See, there's an entire middle section where the Inhumans are basically trapped in limbo. The Inhumans managed to kidnap Forge, but they're supposedly trapped in limbo, but two of them have escaped, and they're two Inhumans, and they're basically gone from there, and then the other Inhumans, like Miss Marvel and Moon Girl and that, they appear as reinforcements. Then Kamala asks, who's actually the good guys? And then it all becomes clear that this is basically a strange kind of, I don't know, weird revenge trip for Emma Frost, which Havoc kind of knows about, and you just kind of, well, hang on, what, eh? You have a fight between Colossus and, was it Gorgon, is it? Yeah, Gorgon's the strong guy one from Inhumans, isn't it?
And with the feet, yeah.
And they have a strong guy versus strong guy fight, where they both acknowledge that they're both strong guys, and I was half expecting Strong Guy from X-Factor to make an appearance and go, no, I'm the strong guy. My name is Strong Guy, literally. And then a three-way strong guy fight to see who is the strong guy. Oh. But that didn't happen, sadly.
Strong guy three-way.
I know.
There's an image. I'm sorry, I had to say something, Rob, because, like, I was sitting here listening to all that.
And getting more confused.
Exactly. Get more bored. Jesus Christ. This is a boring series, Rob.
No, I'm saying that that would have made the series more interesting if Strong Guy just suddenly made a random appearance at that point.
Yeah, it would have, but no. So here we are, the Inhumans and the X-Men. They're still doing their fighting.
Yes, they're still doing their fighty thing.
And then, oh dear God. So a bunch of Inhumans arrive in, like, blimps, and the big, like, moment, the big plot resolution is someone basically just tells Medusa, oh, hey, by the way, this cloud is actually going to kill all the mutants. We should maybe do something about that.
Yeah, that's a bit that kind of annoyed me, because I'm just thinking, hang on, they knew about this already.
Well, yeah, because, like, what happens is Moon Girl being Moon Girl is like, oh, BT Dubs, I built a thing that destroys the Terrigen Cloud.
Which Forge apparently couldn't do.
Yeah, but Moon Girl is... See, this is the problem with having a character like Moon Girl and these things.
Yeah.
Is she can just be like, I built a thing that'll fix the plot.
When did you build this? I built it in, like, I built it in class.
Yeah, she can just, like, pull things basically out her butt.
Yes.
I mean, we can all do that, but, like, her thing's actually useful.
Yeah, and I mean, that whole bit of Medusa being told that it's killing the mutants. And she's saying, well, why didn't they tell us?
Yeah, and she's like immediately, oh no, it's killing the mutants. Oh well, okay, better get rid of the Terran Cloud. Boop. And just like blows it all up.
Yeah, and I'm literally thinking, but that's what this whole thing was about. You knew that's what this whole thing was about. That's why the mutants were so upset. What did you think was going on?
Yeah, it's that. And even before that, like even before it got to this point of, okay, we've got basically hours before it makes the world uninhabitable for mutants.
Yeah.
Like Medusa's whole thing has been, she knows the cloud is slowly killing off the mutants, but it's important for her people, so she's going to do everything she can to help the X-Men, but also she's never ever going to destroy the cloud.
Yeah, I know, and that's the thing that really bugged me, was she did a vice versa on everything, and just kind of, way to go, that's American politician level. You know, flipping right there.
It is. It's just, it's so, oh, what's that? The cloud that's been killing the X-Men is killing the X-Men. We can't have that.
Yes.
And then it somehow gets even dumber. Because then you've got Emma Frost.
Yeah, you're going to talk about this, aren't you?
She's evil now.
Yeah,
she's,
I know. She's evil. That's why I was given the sign, you're going to talk about this, aren't you?
It's so...
I don't like remembering.
She's gone on this complete and utter... So basically her logic is Cyclops would want me to murder all the Inhumans.
Yes.
So I'm going to murder all the Inhumans with these Sentinels that I have somehow from somewhere.
Apparently she made them based on the mutant Sentinel, which I didn't know existed, but hey.
Yeah, which was a thing. Like, where did they even come from? Did she hire to build the... When did it all happen?
I don't know. I don't know. The only thing I know about Inhumans versus X-Men is this, right? It was stupid as a concept, it was stupid in execution, and it was stupid in its resolution, except for one bit, right at the very end.
Oh, no, we'll get to that, because I'm not done with Emma Frost yet. The other thing I want to point out.
Yeah.
Is just how, like, kind of massively sexist it is.
Yeah.
Basically, Emma Frost's whole thing now is, I'm a woman, and my woman hormones have made me crazy, because I love Scott Summers.
Yeah. And the other thing that that bugs me about Emma Frost is, she wasn't that powerful as a telepath. Charles Xavier could come...
She can now, like, suddenly take over everyone's mind.
Yeah, Charles Xavier could take over everyone's mind. That I'm fine with. You know, Jean Grey could do it. That, again, I'm fine with. But Emma Frost? No. No, 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 no. She was basically the poor man's Jean Grey. But she was literally the stand-in for Jean Grey at the Hellfire Club. You know, she...
Yeah, I feel like that is like being a big part of her character, is not being as good a telepath as Jean Grey is.
Yeah. Is it budget Jean Grey or whatever? I don't know. I don't know how you phrase it.
Also, this is kind of like looping back around to basically you're talking about like powers for the first issue.
Yeah.
If Emma Frost is that strong a telepath,
yeah,
why doesn't she just like make all the Inhumans' heads explode?
Exactly. But it does explain why she hates Medusa so much, because she hated Jean Grey, because Jean Grey had apparently stolen Scott Summers, because Scott was such a hunky man, hunky man, and so she hates redheads. So naturally she's going to hate Medusa.
Because she is the reddest head.
Yes. It makes sense when you think about it, doesn't it?
It does. Well done. You've made sense of Inhumans versus X-Men.
Can we not talk about this anymore? I'm getting bad memories of it. It's just...
I felt like we'll just leave off of the ending. Oh my god, wait, no. Okay, first of all, I've never realized there's two things I like.
Okay.
Well, see, the ending was pretty nice, with Medusa, like, abdicating from the throne of the Inhumans, and her and Black Bolt kind of having that moment where they realize they can just be people now.
Yeah, and they have a bar. And it was a very, it was weird because it was a very Lucifer moment for me. That final page of Medusa and Black Bolt, and just, you know, him, was he just you know, shining a glass or something like that at the bar, and she's just looking at him in this really low cut dress, which I don't understand why Marvel continue to do things like that. But anyway, that bit was very Lucifer. It just reminded me of Lucifer for some reason.
It was, but anyway, now. The most important fact.
Yeah.
Emma Frost Sentinels look quite a bit like Megatron.
Yes, they do. They do. They do. And I noticed that, and then all of a sudden I was remembering Megatron, and then my brain went to Robot Chicken version of Megatron. And I'm going to stop there.
But yeah.
Yeah. Let's not forget what happens to Emma Frost at the end. She somehow starts wearing bondage gear again and putting on Scott's helmet.
Oh, no. It's like a combination like Magneto's helmet with Scott's little X-y thing. But it looks so weird because like, it's a massive helmet and like she's got these big bulky shoulder pads.
Yeah.
And no trousers.
Yeah, I know. It's a weird bondage gear type thing. And you just look at it and you go, I'm not sure what this is supposed to be, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be uncomfortable.
Maybe that's fashion now, Rob. We don't know. Maybe that's what's stylish.
What, do we put it on and turn to the left? Song references!
Humans vs. X-Men was a bad series.
It was. It was a very bad series. But there's a much more interesting crossover that we may get to talk about later on. But for now, shall I move on?
Indeed. You do your thingy-majig now.
Okay, I'm going to start off with Aliens Defiance from Dark Horse. And
no, Rob, I won't allow you.
No, why? But I'm defiant. I'm defying you, because it says on front.
That was the joke.
Oh right, okay.
No, I was saying like, well done, you got it.
I actually didn't. It went over my head. I'm bound by my code of honesty.
It's been that kind of a day, hasn't it?
Yes. Anyway,
I say that now, like 12:15.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, Aliens Defiance, and It's basically an alien story through and through, but it's interesting because it is an alien story and it isn't at the same time. You have a private first class Zula Hendricks who, on her first tour and her first battle, she basically gets blown up a couple of times and suffers massive spinal damage and damage to her legs, stuff like that. She's told she'd never walk again. Now she's walking with assistance and stuff like that. And she's trained hard, and she's not allowed back on active duty, but she has been given a special duty to escort a bunch of Weyland-Yutani androids. You know, and the reason why she's going with them is because she's trained as a colonial marine, and she's basically going out with these synth units, and she's on a mission to basically go to this ship, which Weyland-Yutani want investigating. There's a bunch of synthetics with her, all of them are male, and they're basically going to investigate the ship, find out what happened, everything like that. Now, Zula Hendricks, she's wary around the synthetics, and she's not sure, she doesn't really trust them because they're not fully human, and it turns out her instincts are actually correct, because the synthetics stage a mutiny.
Well, as an advocate of synthetic rights...
Yeah.
I'll have you know, that's probably more just because they work for Weyland-Yutani.
I would agree with you on
literally
that.
Literally the most corrupt company ever thought of.
Yes, I would agree with you totally on that. But, well, actually, you're closer than you think as well, because that does form part of it. The other part is that Davis-01, one of the synthetic units, has discovered the true reason why they're on this mission, right? And also the reason why Zula Hendricks is on this mission. And the whole reason for it is because Weyland-Yutani want a sample of the alien. They want a live alien if they can get hold of one. And the best way to get one is human gestation. So yeah, you need somebody but the thing is, you can't just choose anybody. You need somebody who's reasonably expendable. So who better than a severely damaged colonial marine? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So Davis-01 has determined that this is an incorrect course of action. See, Davis-01 hasn't, and the rest of the synth units under Davis-01, they haven't really rebelled. They're just obeying their programming, which is to protect human life. Do you see what I mean? And their programming and Weyland-Yutani's orders conflict with each other. And Weyland-Yutani, while they're in communication range, Weyland-Yutani can override their programming to a degree. But when they cut off the transmissions from Weyland-Yutani, their own programming kicks in, and they work to protect Zula Hendricks. Davis-01 is... he's kind of an abnormal synth unit. He's much more of an aberration than a normal synth unit.
He's a Lance Henriksen rather than a Michael Fassbender.
Yeah, he's more of a Lance Henriksen than a Michael Fassbender. And it's strange to read this because I'm remembering Lance Henriksen, for example, and I'm remembering... the weird thing is, this reminds me of a little bit of Alien 3. In parts, but also reminds me a little bit of Aliens in parts, and it reminds me a little bit of some of the other graphic novels related to Alien or related to the Aliens franchise. It does go back to kind of recapture the old style of the Aliens stories, and I like that. And it is quite tense in parts, and you get more of an idea of just how corrupt Weyland-Yutani actually are. In this graphic novel, I mean, it's volume one, and it's by Brian Wood, Tristan Jones, Riccardo Bertielli, Tony Breschini, and Dan Jackson, and it's a bunch of issues, but they're all really interesting, and the story's told in a bit of a piecemeal fashion, where you have it jumping around a little bit in time, especially where Zula Hendricks is concerned, because it jumps around and tells a little bit about her life as a colonial marine before jumping back to the present, or maybe then jumping into the past of one of the other characters. And I think that fits really well with this type of story because it's fitting the pieces together, but it's maintaining that tension that runs through the story. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I get you.
So, Alien's Defiance, I'm actually glad I read it. It's kind of rekindled after doing the Aliens Omnibus volumes, you know, those really, really awful to mediocre 90s sci-fi omnibus editions that passes...
Oh, you mean the books we did in Literary Loitering?
Yeah, those ones. After reading those, I was kind of sad and didn't really want much to do with the Aliens franchise, but Aliens Defiance has proven to me once more that the best way to do an alien story is let the graphic novelists and the comic book artists deal with it.
See, you say that, but now just imagine, like, coming this summer, Aliens versus Predators 2 Civil War by Brian Michael Bendis.
Yeah, okay, when I say that, there is a proviso. You don't let people like Jeff Loeb, Jim Lee, or Brian Michael Bendis, or anyone like that near the Aliens franchise.
Oh, Jeff also just realised as well.
What?
It would be Aliens versus Predator 3. There was a second Aliens versus Predator film.
Yes, I know. Also on that list of comic book people not to let near the Aliens, all the Predator franchise, Frank Miller and Alan Moore.
I mean, can I add the proviso that if we were able to, like, grab RoboCop versus Terminator Frank Miller from
that,
the past.
Yes.
Pull him to the future.
Yes.
He can write it.
Yes, he can write it. RoboCop versus Terminator Frank Miller. If we can grab him, you know, or if he's lucid enough to return to that form, then yes, fine. I've got no problems because RoboCop versus Terminator was amazing.
Hey? What if we do that? We, like, pull young Frank Miller out of the time stream, have him write this, and the trauma of that is what turns him into modern day Frank Miller.
Oh, God.
And it was us all along that ruined him.
I blame you for having the idea. I had nothing to do with this.
We've created the time loop, damn it.
Okay, I'm done. Your turn.
Now I'm doing a thing that we got sent in by Humanoids Publishing. It's Whispers in the Walls.
Yes.
It is written by David Munoz with art by Tiaso.
Okay, so what's this about then?
So this is set Czechoslovakia, 1949. A young girl called Sarah returns home to find that her family's been brutally killed, like ripped apart.
Oh.
And then a spooky, scary monster jumps out at her.
Okay.
So after that, she kind of blacks out and finds herself in some kind of weird mental institution.
Okay.
Where it's quite obvious the staff are hiding something from her. And as she tries to kind of work out what's going on, she begins hearing a mysterious voice in her head giving her instructions on kind of how to break into the institute's cellar to find out what's going on, and finds a bunch of monster people who've been locked up.
Yeah, it actually sounds like The People Under the Stairs. It's a movie that... it's a Wes Craven movie from... when was it? 1990 or 91, I think it was. This is sounding a bit like that.
But, I mean, what was it about?
Oh, basically, it was about a girl in a house, and her guardians are very weird and strange and a little bit mad. And there's all these weird tunnels and stuff that run through the house, and there are a bunch of kids who live under the stairs, and they look like monsters, but they're not. They've just been trapped there for ages.
Okay, yeah, that does sound fairly similar. But this is more... I think I say this because it's a twist that happens fairly early on.
Yeah.
The institute she's in, basically, like, everything like vampires and werewolves and that are real.
Yeah.
And this institute's kind of dedicated to wiping them out and is also trying to find a way to cure them.
Okay, why would they cure them?
Well, cure things like people who have been bitten by a vampire. They then become a vampire.
Ah, right, I see.
So they're looking for, like, a way to cure them.
So vampirism is like rabies, then?
Yeah, but, well, it's just like, you know, the classic vampire bite. She sucks out your blood, but doesn't completely kill you, and you come back as a vampire.
Okay.
So yeah, but that's literally, like, the first big twist of quite a few. Yeah, it's a good story. Like I said, it's very dark. Lots of twists. But also I like there's a little bit of anime anime and manga reference in there as well.
Okay.
Because you've got things like one of the vampires, you see them kind of like fight some of the guards. And like he basically like drops down between two of them, lights up a cigarette, and then just like slices them both in half with a katana.
Yeah, that's very, very manga.
It is. And like I kind of like the idea that it's not afraid to be a bit over the top. Because I feel like a lot of things, they'll kind of show you something cool, but then say, but this is a very serious story, so we're not allowed to like be, oh, that's cool. We have to remain frowny-faced.
Yeah, never understood that, you know.
Yeah, I like something that's going to throw in that little bit of a flourish to go, look, here's a cool thing that happens. And then you can go, yes, that was a cool thing that happened.
I agree. Cool things that happen are good. Is this a recommend from you?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a recommend. I like the story. The art's pretty good. It can take a little bit of getting used to it first because it's fairly cartoony.
Yeah.
But I think that kind of works, like, especially once a lot of the monsters get introduced and you see how it kind of plays into like how over-exaggerated their features are.
Yeah.
And there's some really nice designs in there, like the people at the Institute have got this very kind of steampunk electro armor with like these kind of electrically powered knuckle duster things, which look very nice. But in some kinds, people can look a little bit lumpy.
Lumpy?
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess maybe gangly is more the word.
Okay. I kind of get what you mean.
Yeah, like things maybe aren't, like they're just a little bit out of proportion.
Yeah, I can kind of get what you mean. I've seen similar things.
Okay, good. Like I am making at least something resembling sense.
Yeah. Well, when you read as many comic books and manga as we do, you know, you kind of understand what you mean. I can visualize it because of, well, various comics and manga I've read. So when you describe it as kind of lumpy or maybe more gangly, I've got an image in my head of how it might look, so I can kind of understand.
Okay, cool. But yeah, for the most part, it's a really good graphic novel, and I would heartily recommend it.
Cool. So, is it me with the beast?
It is you. You can unleash the beast.
Isn't just any beast. This is an 844-page beast.
Oof.
Yes. This is Dororo by Osamu Tezuka, and it's not just any Dororo, right? This is a Dororo like no other Dororo that you've ever seen before. Dororo.
God damn it, you're doing this deliberately, aren't you? Because I can't say it. It's Dororo. Is it
It's not Dora the Explorer. It's not Dora the Explorer. It's not Durarara.
Durarara.
It's not that either. It's Dororo.
Oh my God. Why is it so? It shouldn't be complicated, but it is.
Yes, it is. And this is. Yeah, this is basically.
I think I might have broken slightly.
Okay, right. This is basically, I don't know how to describe this. This is the complete omnibus edition of Osamu Tezuka's Dororo, which is one of the most important manga that was ever made, right? And to actually have the complete set here, the complete omnibus edition of it, and to have the chance to read the complete omnibus edition, I regard as an actual privilege. Let me put it that way. I have read this before years ago in separate volumes, and it is just as good now as it was then, because Tezuka had a very simple but very direct style of writing and drawing. It's a supernatural thriller that's about a wandering ronin called Hyakkimaru and the young orphan thief called Dororo, who is the, you know, who's basically the titular character. Hyakkimaru is the name Hyakkimaru is a weird one, because if I remember rightly, it means something like little monster, and the name Dororo is actually the name was actually taken from Tezuka's childhood memories of the way his friends pronounced the word thief in Japan, which is Dorobo. So that's basically why Dororo is thief. Oh, the character of Dororo is an orphan who's basically a thief. And this is during the Sengoku period, and it starts off with a baby in a basket in a river who's picked up by a medicine seller, doctor-type character, right? This baby is Hyakkimaru, little monster, but the baby was born severely malformed. No limbs and no facial features and no internal organs, but still alive somehow. And the baby is actually the son of Daimyo Daigo Kagemitsu, who forged a pact with 48 demons, 48 sealed demons, in order to rule the world. And in return, he promised them that they could each obtain a piece of his unborn child's body.
But doesn't really have much to go around.
No. So 48 pieces of Hyakkimaru's body are basically with 48 demons who used to be sealed. And his mom, fearing that that Daigo was going to kill his son, his mom put him in a basket, wrapped him and put him in a basket and sent him down river, a bit like the whole Moses thing, right? So he gets picked up by this doctor who initially is, he's wondering if it's actually human, then realizes this baby is actually human. So the doctor uses his skills and everything to create these prosthetics for the young Hyakkimaru, you know, glass beads, his eyes, stuff like that. And Hyakkimaru learns to use his intuition, his kind of extrasensory perception, almost. It's not quite ESP, but it's almost there because he has nothing else. He's got no arms, legs, anything like that. So he has to rely on other things. And so he's got this kind of daredevil-style vision, I suppose you'd call it, even though he doesn't have ears. And he sets out to basically regain the parts of his body that he's lost. And so along the way, he meets Dororo, who's a thief. And Dororo and Hyakkimaru are both very, very damaged characters. And throughout the course of the story, you actually find out just how damaged they are. But there's a funny bit to this, because Dororo and Hyakkimaru, they're basically bond like, you know, best buddies, like brothers, that sort of thing, right? They're basically bond like that. But there's a big twist to that, which, I mean, this is like a 1960s manga, so I'm not sure whether I can spoil that twist or not.
I would say maybe not. It's like a really big part of the story.
Well, this is the thing. It should be a big part of the story, but this is one of the genius bits of Tezuka's writing. If it was done today by anybody else, it would be a major twist that would change the tone and nature of the story, but Tezuka didn't let that happen.
Also, I would like to point out...
Yes?
That before you start talking about this...
Yeah?
I had completely mixed up Dororo and Doraemon. And I've been sitting here like, but when does the little blue guy come in?
Never, never, never. Let me put it this way. Dororo is the kind of manga that if I gave it to you, you'd read it and you'd come back to me and say, I really enjoyed that, because you like your horror, right? And Doraemon is not a horror, but Dororo has a lot of horrific parts. One of the nicest...
Oh, God damn it, because I only let you have this, because I think, God, I don't want like 800 pages of like weird blue seal thing.
I offered it to you first.
I know, but you should have realised that I was thinking of something else.
I did. How am I supposed to know that?
You're supposed to read my mind, Rob.
Okay.
You're supposed to just know in advance.
Anyway, it's 844 pages of Tezuka brilliance. This is basically a masterclass in how to do a manga that is very straightforward, very direct, and doesn't really pull many punches. Tezuka was a brilliant observer of the human condition, let's say. And there's a brilliant scene in this, and it's repeated a couple of times throughout the manga, where Hyakkimaru and Dororo, they basically save this village from this demon that's taken over the body of a girl. And the girl is obviously dead, so they have to bury her. But Dororo has been injured. And Hyakkimaru says, lend us a house so I can look after Dororo. And the villagers look at her and go, no, we don't want you here. You're creepy. Your arm falls off. And he just looks at them and he just says, okay, Dororo, looks like we're not welcome here, and starts walking away. And the villagers are just watching them go. And you just think, that is literally it. You know, he can't get a break because these people are just terrified of the fact that he is like the demons he's killing. And Dororo is a thief. a very direct and self-confessed thief, but she's still a thief. And these villagers are so, they're so simple-minded. I wouldn't say stupid, I'd say simple-minded and not very worldly wise. And because of that, they're very insular. So they're happy to accept the help of strangers, but when those strangers need help themselves, they basically say no, because they're trying to look after themselves first. And that was one of the things that was prominent in Japan for a long time, and Tezuka, really picked up on that and really shows that in quite a few of his stories, because it wasn't something that he liked as part of the kind of he didn't believe that was the way Japanese people should be.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it kind of plays a lot into that whole idea of, the wandering samurai.
Yeah, yeah. Hyakkimaru is the wandering samurai, but I'm not going to go too into detail about this because it's 844 pages, right? There's a lot there. This is the Omnibus Edition. Track it down, get it, read it. Tezuka at his finest. You will not be disappointed.
I don't actually want to read this now.
I did give you first dibs with it.
I know, but I thought it was a different thing.
Well, we will meet up at some point and you can grab it.
Trigun is a thing about guns, right?
Yes.
It's about a man who has a special gun.
Yes.
Okay, at least that's what I'm thinking of. Also, there's some foreshadowing for something I might be doing in the future.
Yes. So, anyway, right, your turn.
So, what I've started reading is another Image series, The Beauty.
I've heard about this one. What's it about?
Yeah, it's pretty... Actually, before I go into it, I think this is one that... Oh, the Rob, the mysterious figure in the background of The Geek Show, recommended to me.
Yeah, I remember it now. It's the one that he recommended to you when we were in that comic book store, and you were going, my God.
Yeah, and I started just, buying everything.
And he was just amazed that he actually managed to recommend to you a comic book that you'd never heard of.
Yeah, so credit where it's due. So, The Beauty, this is by Jason A. Hurley and Jeremy Howne. It's basically set kind of in a world similar to our own, only there's a hot new STD on the streets.
Hang on, what?
It's a sexually transmitted disease called The Beauty.
And it's a hot new STD.
Oh, yes. Because here's the twist. The symptoms of the disease include turning into just, the most perfectly beautiful human being on the planet. All your fat will melt away. Your jawline will kind of firm up. You have other things that attractive people have. I don't know. Hair. That's something that the pretty people have. They have hair.
And noses. And nostrils.
Yeah.
They also have,
I hate them.
They also have eyebrows. Cheekbones. I often hear that beautiful people have good cheekbones.
Yes. I remember that time on American Horror Story, Lady Gaga said, my boy has cheekbones for days.
Yeah. Just don't understand.
So basically what happens is now, 50% of the world basically has this disease. Because there's lots of people going out and deliberately getting themselves infected.
Okay.
Because why wouldn't you be? It's basically looking amazing for the price of having a bit of a fever.
Okay.
Only then things start to change. There's a very attractive woman sitting on subway train, and suddenly she just explodes from the inside out. All her internal organs combust.
So the beauty is basically a killer?
Yes. There is a fatal side effect.
And nobody noticed this until now?
No, because apparently it's something that only kicks in after kind of a couple of years.
Okay.
So the series is about two detectives called Vaughn and Foster who initially start looking into the death of this woman. They discover it's kind of linked to the beauty and end up getting involved in a huge government conspiracy kind of involving a corrupt pharmaceutical company that wants to keep it under wraps so that they can produce... It's not even a cure, just medication that prolongs people's lifespans instead. Get rich off of it.
Mm.
And kind of an underground organization that's actually figured out how to cure it and is looking for a way to disperse the cure.
Okay, this sounds more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of interesting mix of sort of horror and spy thriller stuff.
And one of the things that's got me interested in this is normally when you have this kind of killer disease, you know, and you have like a pandemic infection, they normally go down the zombie route or something like that. You know, or just
I like that they've avoided zombies.
You know, or just like kind of a mass outbreak. You know, the movie Outbreak, the Dustin Hoffman one, where you had that town and it was Ebola or wherever it was and everyone's dying and there's, you know, the streets are filled with the dead and there's a cart going, bring out your dead, and everything like that. So those are the two routes that they normally go with these sorts of infection stories, and beauty is, you know, the beauty isn't going down that route, and that makes me interested in reading it.
Also, I really like, and another movie it weirdly reminds me of.
Oh?
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Ooh, actually.
Because there's kind of like this level of paranoia about, oh, look, that person is attractive, but could it be that they have this disease? I don't know now.
That's a really interesting comparison. I like that.
Yeah, and I think like possibly one of my new like top characters is Detective Foster. Because at the start of the series, she's someone who has been unknowingly infected with the disease. Like, you know, she got jiggy with someone, woke up the next morning to find she had this. And I like the idea that she hates it.
Yeah.
And there's kind of like this idea that she feels a bit violated, that this thing has like come into her body and just completely like changed how she looks.
Yeah.
And I love that as an idea. It's a very interesting series and full of cool moments. Like, there's a guy as well who's like a hitman sent by the pharmaceutical company called a Calaveras. And like, he just like strolls up in like a 3-piece suit, fedora, like Mexican Day of the Dead skull mask.
Nice.
And like, there's this bit towards the end where he basically like sends his team of killers into a building and then the building explodes. And then like, he just turns to face like the one surviving member and says, "Well, guess it's just you and me now. You're driving."
I like that.
This is it. The beauty. I'm enjoying it a heck of a lot. So again, it's another hearty recommend.
Cool. Cool.
See, this is good. This is good. A couple of nice comic books to wash away the horrible taste of Inhumans versus X-Men.
Well, I have something else that can wash away the horrible taste of Inhumans versus X-Men.
Is it the Super Secret crossover?
Yes, it is.
Ooh, what is it?
The Super Secret crossover that no one seems to know exists, and it's called Monsters Unleashed.
Oh, see, do you know what the irony is, Rob?
Yeah?
That was supposed to be, like, Marvel's next big event.
Was it?
Yeah.
Really?
But no one remembers it.
No one remembers it, and they went with Secret Empire instead. Because this is so much better.
Oh yeah, this is like the thing that was supposed to be coming like before Secret Empire. I think it's just got to the point where no one cares anymore.
Yeah, I know, but that's the thing. Monsters Unleashed is so much better than Inhumans versus X-Men and everything else. And I found it. Literally, I found it when I saw the cover, Totally Awesome Hulk versus a Big Giant Monster. It said Monsters Unleashed. I'm like, ooh, what's this? And then I found Monsters Unleashed was actually a crossover event happening. It's being pitched as an epic battle that Marvel fans have been waiting for. And it's all hands on deck with Avengers, Champions, Guardians, X-Men, and the Inhumans as they clash with monstrous threats that threaten to destroy every corner of the Marvel Universe. Who are the Leviathans? Who controls them? How can they be stopped before Earth becomes another tragic, barren world in their wake? And it's written by Cullen Bunn, right? With the art by Steve McNiven. And it's 4 issues in. Okay, and this is the main series. But it's got these addendum bits to it, which are really good. And it's basically the Marvel Universe is invaded by kaiju that a teenage kid called Kay, who's sad and a bit lonely, has been summoning kind of by accident on purpose for some goal that still isn't that clear.
Yeah, and yet this is the problem with Marvel, is that pretty much as soon as that started, they were like hyping Secret Empire instead.
But this is so much better than Secret Empire. And you have Elsa Bloodstone, who is basically investigating this in her best treasure hunting guise, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And you have...
I do like Elsa Bloodstone.
I know you do. But you've got in Springfield, Missouri, you got some kid called Kay who's basically drawing these monsters, and then these monsters appear, and you know, you got teams like the Avengers and the Champions fighting these monsters that Kay's drawing, you know? And this is the first issue has this brilliant, brilliant bit at the end, right? Where you got Kay, he's run out the house, and he's confronted by Fing Fang Foom, right? And I'm thinking, Fing Fang Foom, what's he doing here?
Is he going to put him in his pants?
No, this Fing Fang Foom is
but that's what Fing Fang Foom does.
But this Fing Fang Foom is a lot more articulate, because I think this Fing Fang Foom is something that was drawn by Kay, so that means it's a bit more intelligent. And Kay is in the forest surrounded by these four huge monsters, including Fing Fang Foom, who's the biggest of all of them, and says, "Heed my warnings, boy. Whatever it is you think you're doing, no matter what you hope to accomplish by summoning us, you are playing a dangerous game." And then everything hits the fan after that.
Yeah, so that sounds like kind of a fun series.
Well, one of the best bits about this is the Totally Awesome Hulk crossover when Maddie Shaw, she gets in touch with, you know, that monster hunter woman from who tried to kidnap Amadeus in his Hulk form, and Amadeus has a bit of a crush on her.
Oh, yeah, the Lady Hell something, yeah. I think.
So anyway, she's basically freeing monsters again and taking them to the sanctuary so they'll be protected. And Maddie somehow manages to get in touch with her, and Maddie says, "Yeah, we've got a serious monster problem on Earth. There's these giant monsters appearing left, right, and centre. We need a bit of help. Can you give us some advice? You know, or can you come and help us?" She goes, "Okay, I've cleaned up here." And Maddie's basically helped her clean up where she is, because Maddie's genius as well. And then she basically says, "Yeah, there's something called the Leviathans, and this Lady Hell, whatever her name is," she's got this look on her face like, oh snap, right? And she goes, "Get everyone you can and leave the planet. Your planet is doomed. Save as many people as you can."
That's how the Marvel Universe ended.
See, the thing is, when you have in just a separate crossover comic for a comic, and you have a character saying, "Your planet's doomed, save as many as you can," and this person is actually going around freeing monsters and taking them to safety, you know she's a bit hard as nails, and she knows what she's talking about. And that's just in, like, one of the addendum comics to the main Monsters Unleashed series. So, I'm really enjoying this. It's basically everything I wanted Marvel crossovers to be. You know, all hands on deck, let's fight the big bad, you know, let's all just go, you know, hell for leather, all guns blazing, you know, bam, pow, you know, crack a theme, everything like that. Old-style Marvel, big punch-up.
Yeah, I guess it sounds like the kind of thing where it makes sense why this is involving everyone.
Yeah.
Like, this is more than even the Avengers could handle just by themselves.
Yeah. And you have these monsters appearing all over the world. Nowhere is actually safe. They just keep appearing in Wakanda, in Russia, in Australia, literally everywhere. It's like they're infesting everywhere, and they just keep appearing and appearing. And the heroes are basically fighting what might actually be a losing battle. And I love the fact that they're doing that. And that's, you don't need all of this kind of secret empire nonsense. You don't need all of this Terrigen and Cloud mumbo jumbo, you know, from Inhumans versus X-Men. You don't need any of that. Just straight up, give them a big monster, or a whole bunch of big monsters in this case, that are threatening humanity, and let the heroes do what they're supposed to do. Let them actually be heroes. Let them be the first and last line of defense for the human race and for the planet Earth. That's where they shine, you know? Get rid of all the politics. Remove all that. This is old-style comic books with heroes doing what they do best. Being heroes. And that's why I love it. That's why I think this is what they should be doing.
Cool. I think it's just, I'm struggling to get as excited as you are, because I think I'm pretty burned out on events.
You are burned out on events, and this is the thing. This is the kind of comic where you have... there's a brilliant bit in the second issue where it basically goes from Las Vegas, where you have a giant monster wrecking the city, to Moscow, where you have a giant monster wrecking the city, to, you know, the Hoover Dam, where you have a giant monster wrecking a bridge. You know, and you have heroes from these...
See, I was almost worried you were going to say, to the Hoover Dam, where a giant monster is wrecking the city.
Yeah. And then it goes to Edinburgh, where you have I think it's Valkyrie on a flying horse, and a few others. And you've got these different heroes in each of these areas, and they're all trying to fight these monsters. And that's me. You know, that's what I like. And Moon Girl is trying to keep Devil Dinosaur under control, so you know, so he doesn't get confused as one of the monsters, you know? Although I don't like the way they've drawn Moon Girl in this.
Right.
Yeah. Although Elsa Bloodstone is amazing in this. And she plays a much bigger role in Monsters Unleashed than you think.
Well, I mean, it is kind of like her wheelhouse.
Yeah. She's basically doing what she does best, investigating, following through, and finding out information, you know? So, yeah, it's Monsters Unleashed. My recommendation. This is the Marvel crossover you should be reading. Forget about Secret Empire and the rest of them. You know, this and Revolutionaries from IDW.
God, there's so many crossovers.
I know, but there's only two good ones so far this year. Revolutionaries and Monsters Unleashed. Forget about everything else.
I think you're technically incorrect.
Oh?
Because thanks to Marvel having, like, literally no idea how to publish things, Secret Wars is technically an event of this year, and that was pretty good.
Hey, what?
Yeah, Secret Wars, it ended in, like, January of this year. Because the final issue got pushed back, like, months and months and months.
We're not counting Secret Wars.
Just saying, it technically came out in 2076. Was it? Oh my god, how long has it even been? Was it like 60? Has it been a whole? Oh my god, it's been like a whole year. It's like 2016. Oh my, how does time work, Rob? I'm so confused.
I don't know. I don't know anymore. Anyway, right. This is Monsters Unleashed, and
Secret Wars was an entire year ago. Oh my god.
Yes, I know. Monsters Unleashed, thankfully, hasn't been an entire year ago, but it is a fun read. And it's basically a fun crossover. Marvel should be doing more like this. That's all I've got to say about it.
Okay. Even if I had something clever to add, I think...
Your brain is shut down.
Yes, I'm broken. Thank you for finishing the sentence. I couldn't.
Right. If your brain shut down, should I send you to sleep?
Show am is end now, yes.
Yeah. That's what I mean by should I send you to sleep.
I think so.
Okay. I was going to do Gwenpool number 13, but I'm not going to. But I will tell you one thing. It's fourth wall breaker versus fourth wall breaker.
So do they break the mythical eighth wall?
No. Basically, Gwenpool makes Deadpool realize that he was beating up on a teenage girl. And he's like, oh, right. that's not going to go down too well.
That's absolutely fair.
He's like, Arcade's the real bad guy here, right? Yeah. Because it starts off with Deadpool kicking everyone's ass, going, yeah, I'm the big bad and everything like that. And Gwenpool asks him a fair question. He's like, okay, so if you know you're in a comic book, right, then why the hell are you following his story? Why aren't you doing your own? And he's like, we're all just people living here. And then there's just this massive pause because he's got a knife at Gwenpool's throat. And he's like, and then he throws the knife away. He's like, oh, let's try this again. Hi, I'm Deadpool.
Oh, no, it's too meta. Yeah. I wasn't prepared for that.
The conversation between Gwenpool and Deadpool is hilarious because Deadpool's like, I've never heard of you. Who are you? You know, because she says, oh, yeah, we're in my comic book. And he's like, oh, we have a fourth wall breaker. Okay. And he starts breaking the fourth wall in a big way. He's like, I've had this, I've had that. I've even had the highest grossing R-rated movie of all time. Who are you? What, you know, you're just a bit part character in Howard the Duck.
Every time you talk about Gwenpool, it makes me remember that. I really need to read it at some point.
Yeah, I'm glad that they inserted that they basically put Deadpool in when they did because it was getting a bit stale, and I think this has just injected a little bit of that much-needed humour to it. And I like the way this ended because it ended in kind of a it ended in kind of a patsy walkaway. Gwenpool has made some mistakes, but... She's determined to try and correct them. So with Megatony, she's basically got him a job doing what he loves doing, which is inventing. And Batroc is going to go off and do whatever Batroc does when he's by himself. And the other lass who has the mask, she's basically joined a school of witches, so she's good. So there's only one person left who she needs to help, and that's her ghost friend, who's currently being chased by Bible-bashing rednecks with shotguns.
Of course. Also, I'd like to point out...
Yes?
Literally just realised, Megatony is Megaton with a Y.
Yeah, I know.
That's the joke.
So, yeah. Gwenpool continues to surprise me. Oh, and that whole rant of Deadpool's, he does point out that whenever someone says her name, they're not thinking of her, they're thinking of Gwen Stacy. And when I was reading that, I was like, oh, low blow, dude.
Too meta.
So, yeah. That was actually one of the better Deadpool moments that I've seen him in recent times. And I didn't even get onto Micronauts searching someone's house, but at their diminutive size, there's a brilliant picture of Acroyer holding up a toilet seat and pointing his sword down the wall.
Okay, good stuff.
While he's standing on the rim of the toilet, because he's so tiny.
Yeah, I got that.
We're at the end of the show, so we're going to leave you for a slightly longer period of time this time, because we are making various changes in the background that you will see soon. And I don't know why I've got this kind of weird, you know, American TV presenter look on my face when I'm doing this voice.
See, now I can't just picture you in, like, the checkered jacket.
That's exactly what I was picturing. You know where they have that slightly side-on look at the camera and their eyes are squinted a little bit and they've got that, like, scrunched-up nose, but they've also got that grin while they're talking?
Yeah, no, I can absolutely picture what you...
I don't know why I was doing that. I just literally caught myself doing that. I was like, please don't change wind. I don't want my face to stay like this.
Oh, wait, now let's check behind door number one.
Andrew Young, come on down. It's your turn to play The Price is Right. So, yeah, anyway, we're going to do a few changes in the background, but we'll be back after a little bit. In the meantime, you can find us on iTunes and Mixcloud and YouTube and various other places on the internet. And as I said, if you want to get in touch with us, just email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Anyway, until we see you all on the next episode, and by that point, Andrew will have Trigun.
Oh, that's such a very threatening.
Yes, you'll have Triguns.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I'll have Trigun whether I want it or not.
Yes, you will, whether you want it or not. This time I'm not letting you decide, okay? I let you decide with Dororo, and you said no, because you got confused. I'm taking the decision out of your hands. You are having Trigun.
I'm just going to wake up in like the middle of the night with the alarm going off and find just a copy of Trigun through a smashed window.
Or you wake up in the morning and there's a copy of Trigun with the rose on top of it.
Oh no, that's even worse. Turn over in bed and it's just there next to me.
Oh, I actually managed to scare myself with that one. Oh, brain, you shock me sometimes with what you do. Oh, anyway, until next time, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.